the case of symptoms similar to those of COVID-19, such as fever, cough, sore throat, loss of taste, or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
That's okay. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I am here asking for your support, for your help, and labor justice, because I fear for my life.
3 years ago, Mexican journalist Lourdes Maldonado pleaded with Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador for help because she feared for her life. On Sunday, she was shot dead in Tijuana, becoming the third journalist killed in Mexico this month. We go to Tijuana to speak with the Committee to Protect Journalists, then to the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem, where Israeli forces recently evicted a Palestinian family, demolishing their home. We'll speak to the Palestinian poet and activist Mohammed Okurd.
The punishment is the process itself. It's losing your youth, losing your hope, losing the prospects of your future to the lingering threat of homelessness at all times. And this reality is not just for people in Sheikh Jarrah, it's a reality for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians all across Palestine.
And finally, downfall, the case against Boeing. A new documentary that just premiered at the Sundance Film Festival looks at the two fatal crashes in Ethiopia and Indonesia that killed all 346 on board the Boeing 737 MAX planes.
An Ethiopian Airlines flight has crashed shortly after takeoff.
2 days after the second crash, we knew that this plane appeared to be defective in some manner.
It was their greed. Are the profits more important than the human life?
We'll speak to director Rory Kennedy and Michael Stumo, whose daughter Samia died in the Ethiopian air crash. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A Russian foreign ministry official said Thursday the U.S. risks provoking a nuclear missile crisis with Moscow unless the U.S. and its NATO allies ensure restraint and predictability in the growing conflict over Ukraine. The stark warning came as Russia's top diplomat Sergei Lavrov formally rejected a U.S. response to Russia's demands that offered no new concessions.
The main question is our clear message that we consider further NATO expansion to the east and weapons deployment, which can threaten Russian Federation, unacceptable.
On Thursday, President Biden reportedly warned Ukraine's president in a phone call that Russia could invade Ukraine in February. The U.S. has called a meeting of the U.N. Security Council to discuss the crisis Monday. That's one day before Russia set to take over the rotating presidency of the council. President Biden confirmed Thursday he'll nominate the first black woman Supreme Court justice. He made the commitment at a White House event for retiring Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Meanwhile, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell warned Biden against a nominee backed by the, quote, radical left, as Republicans indicated they would seek to draw out the confirmation process. President Biden says he'll nominate the candidate by the end of February. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, is holding an emergency summit today to discuss the bloc's response to the recent military coup in Burkina Faso. On Thursday, coup leader Lieutenant Colonel Paul-Henri Damiba gave his first televised address since he'd led a mutiny that deposed President Kabore Monday.
It is clear that the main priority remains security. We must significantly reduce the areas under terrorist influence and the impact of violent extremism by giving the security forces and the volunteers for homeland defense the will to fight and to go on the offensive.
According to U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, Damiba received training on multiple occasions from the U.S. military. Since 2008, African military officers trained at American American so-called peacekeeping programs have successfully led or attempted at least 9 coups across West Africa. In Honduras, Xiomara Castro was sworn in Thursday as the first woman president in Honduran history. Thousands of supporters attended Castro's inauguration ceremony at the National Stadium in the capital, Tegucigalpa. During her speech, Castro ordered free electricity for Hondurans living in extreme poverty, vowed justice for Berta Cáceres and other murdered land and water defenders, and said her government will not continue to loot Honduras.
La pobreza se incrementó.
Poverty increased by 74% to make us the poorest country in Latin America. This figure by itself explains the migrant caravan of thousands of people of all ages who flee to the North, Mexico, and the United States, looking for a place and a way to subsist, regardless of the risk it implies for their lives.
Castro's presidency marks the end of a brutal 12-year regime by the U.S.-backed right-wing National Party, which first came to power after the 2009 U.S.-backed coup that overthrew Castro's husband, President Manuel Zelaya. This comes as many are demanding outgoing Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez be indicted and extradited to the United States to face charges of aiding drug traffickers like his brother. In Japan, 6 people who developed thyroid cancer in the aftermath of the 2011 Fukushima nuclear meltdown filed a landmark lawsuit against the Tokyo Electric Power Company. The plaintiffs were age 6 to 16 at the time of the devastating earthquake and tsunami, which triggered one of the world's worst nuclear disasters. A court acquitted former executives from the utility company in 2019. Meanwhile, a plan to release wastewater from the Fukushima plant starting next year has sparked international condemnation. At least 70 people in Southern Africa were killed as Tropical Storm Anna struck Madagascar this week before slamming into Mozambique and Malawi. Torrential rains triggered landslides and caused flooding that washed away bridges, submerged farmers' fields, and damaged tens of thousands of homes. Hardest hit was Madagascar, where the UN says 1 million people are already facing severe hunger from food shortages brought on by acute drought. Last year, the World Food Program warned Madagascar faced the first ever famine caused by climate change. Meanwhile, one of the largest icebergs ever observed has broken up in the southern Atlantic Ocean. When it drifted away from Antarctica in 2017, iceberg A68A was roughly the size of Delaware, weighing in at an estimated 1 trillion tons. Scientists warn melting ice from the berg has dumped billions of tons of fresh water into salty seas near South Georgia Island, with unknown consequences for marine life and the environment. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. has canceled oil and gas leases in the Gulf of Mexico, ruling the Biden administration's auction of 80 million acres last year failed to sufficiently account for the climate crisis. It's a major victory for environmentalists who've been fighting what would have been the largest sale of offshore oil and gas leases in U.S. history. The Los Angeles City Council has voted to prohibit new oil and gas wells and phase out existing wells within city limits. The measure also creates a program to help oil and gas workers transition to jobs in other industries. Los Angeles Council President Nuri Martinez spoke ahead of Wednesday's unanimous vote.
For far too long, neighborhood drilling has disproportionately affected the health of our low-income communities of color. From freeways to power plants, our frontline communities bear the brunt of pollution and climate impacts.
A 2021 study by University of Southern California researchers found residents of majority Black and Latinx communities in South Los Angeles who live near oil and gas sites have lower lung function, which may contribute to environmental health disparities. President Biden heads to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania today to promote his recently passed $1 trillion infrastructure bill. Hours before Biden's visit, a bridge connecting Pittsburgh's Regent Square and Squirrel Hill neighborhoods collapsed. No injuries were reported at the time of this broadcast, but residents reported a strong smell of natural gas in the area. The U.S. Coast Guard has suspended its search for dozens of migrants who are feared dead after their boat capsized off the coast of Florida on Saturday. 5 bodies have been found, while 34 people are still missing. One survivor was rescued earlier this week as he clung to the hull of the sinking boat, which had departed from the Bahamas. Oklahoma prison officials have carried out the first execution in the United States this year. 46-year-old Donald Grant was strapped to a gurney at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in McAllister Thursday morning and injected with a lethal cocktail of three drugs. He was declared dead at 10:16 a.m. Grant had asked federal courts to halt his killing, saying Oklahoma's lethal injection protocol presented an unconstitutional risk of pain and suffering. It was Oklahoma's third execution since the death penalty was reinstated after a six-year pause that followed a string of botched executions. Last October, 60-year-old John Marion Grant convulsed and repeatedly vomited after he was administered a sedative in an execution that witnesses described as drawn out and tortuous. Here in New York, workers at an Amazon warehouse in Staten Island will vote on whether to unionize their workplace. The effort is being led by Chris Smalls, who Amazon fired in March of 2020 after he organized a wildcat strike demanding sanitized workspaces, protective masks, and COVID-19 tests for workers. The Staten Island Amazon workers will vote on whether to join a grassroots worker group called the Amazon Labor Union, which is unaffiliated with any national union. Elsewhere in New York City, hundreds of street vendors led a march to Times Square Thursday demanding labor protections and for the city to stop issuing heavy fines to vendors who haven't been able to get selling permits. Bronx Council member Pirina Sanchez is backing new legislation that would end the criminalization of street vendors and increase the number of vending permits.
So we're coming to 10,000 permits just about by 2032. It sounds good, right?
Yeah.
It sounds okay. Except you think about the fact that there are 20,000 street vendors on our streets today. All they want to do is feed their families. All they want to do is make ends meet.
And Saturday marks 20 years since then-President George W. Bush branded the nations of Iraq, Iran, and North Korea the axis of evil during his first State of the Union address.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
A little over a year later, the U.S. invaded Iraq despite lacking any evidence Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. The attack was widely considered illegal under international law. According to the Cost of War Project at Brown University, there have been over 180,000 Iraqi civilians killed by direct violence since the U.S. invasion. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Mexico, where a wave of murders of journalists in the last 2 weeks prompted reporters and their supporters to take to the streets and protest nationwide Tuesday.
I'm here with a lot of grief because more than 100 journalists have been murdered in the last couple of years. No matter how many times we protested, I was in several protests, one in 2008 dubbed We Want to Be Alive, one right after the killing of Javier Valdez. Despite all our protests, the killing of journalists continue. I come here with more sadness than indignation.
Mexico is one of the deadliest countries in the world for journalists. Yesterday, people gathered in Tijuana, a city bordering the United States, for the funeral of reporter Lourdes Maldonado López, a well-known broadcast journalist who had already faced multiple attacks on her life when she was shot dead in front of her home Sunday. She was the third Mexican reporter killed in the first weeks of 2022. On January 17th, another Tijuana journalist, Margarito Martinez, was shot dead in front of his residence after he had just returned from an assignment. He covered police and crime and worked as a fixer for international media. On January 10th, the body of reporter José Luis Gamboa was found in the state of Veracruz after he was stabbed to death. The murder of Lourdes Maldonado has drawn widespread attention. She was reportedly enrolled in a protection program for journalists overseen by the Mexican government. She had a panic button in her house. In 2019, she went to a press briefing with the Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and pleaded for his help.
I am here asking for your support, for your help, and labor justice, because I fear for my life. I know that there's nothing I can do against the corruption I'm experiencing in Tijuana and with this powerful person without your support, Mr. President.
That was 2019. This is Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador responding this week to the murder of Lourdes Maldonado.
I wanted to address this murder, deplorable and painful,
like many other cases, but this one in particular. We are going to investigate thoroughly. I'm saying this because yesterday there were reports that she was here. Reports saying she went to the president asking for protection, and now look what happened. As if we dismissed her, as if we didn't care and left her without protection.
This comes as Lourdes Dog refused to move from guarding the entrance to her home this week after she was killed. For more on the calls from Mexican authorities to investigate these killings and what should be done, we go to Tijuana to speak with Jan Albert Hudson. He's the Mexico correspondent for the Committee to Protect Journalists. He attended Lourdes' funeral yesterday. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Jan. This is a horrible loss for so many, not only in Mexico. You were at the funeral. Can you describe it for us? You spent time with the family. Tell us who was there and what the family is demanding.
Hi, thanks to be here. Yes, I was yesterday at Lourdes' funeral here in Tijuana. It was a relatively small-scale event. I think there were about 40 people, and at least half of them were journalists. It's a big story here in Tijuana because most of the journalists here in the city actually knew Lourdes. So for them, it was extra tragic. They had to gather at the graveyard here in Tijuana and basically cover the murder of their own friend and colleague. The family of Lourdes was there. They were there were family members from the United States who lived in San Diego, just across the border, and family members from here in Tijuana. They spoke briefly with the media, amongst them myself, and they were asking for justice. Her brother said that they forgave the people who did this, and otherwise they are very anxiously waiting for the Mexican authorities to provide them with an update about what happened. And I think, going back to your other question, what should be done? I think that's the first thing that should be done. Authorities here in the state of Baja California need to provide clarity on who might be involved and what might be the motive behind this killing, because we don't know that so far.
So can you talk about the kind of reporting that she did, and also the fact that she had a panic button in her house?
Sure. She was a online radio and television show host. She worked for a streaming provider called Sintoniza Sin Fronteras. And as such, she had several shows each week in which it was her commenting on local events. She never pulled any punches. It was about politics. It was about crime and security, Tijuana being one of the most dangerous cities in Mexico right now. She also addressed the murder of her colleague Margarito Martinez 1 week earlier. And according to the Baja California state authorities, which I spoke with earlier this week, she was enrolled in a protection scheme and she had a panic button at home in her house. But, you know, at 7 p.m. when she got back, when she was attacked, apparently she didn't have the panic button with her. And another thing that actually we need more clarity about is that the Baja California state authorities told me that she had regular police check-ins, meaning a patrol car would check in with her residence every once in a while to see if she was okay. And apparently this wasn't enough, and they were not present at the time when she was attacked. So this means that whatever security measures the Mexican state had provided her, they've been woefully insufficient.
One of Lourdes Maldonado's last broadcasts was January 19th. It was dedicated to the Tijuana photojournalist, Jan, who you just mentioned, Margarito Martinez, who was assassinated outside his home last week. This is a clip of Lourdes on her own program, Brebaje, which means potion, paying homage to Margarito, not knowing she'd be killed days later herself.
Margarito's death, his assassination, has left a big hole in journalism. He was recognized around the world for his work, reporting on the violence in Baja California, on the murders. He had tremendous knowledge on these issues.
Jan Albert Hudson, you know, we, in addition to having you on, we're trying to reach some Mexican journalists in Tijuana, but no one would come on, fearful for what it could mean, how much danger they face. Can you talk about the danger they face and what this federal protection program is for journalists and why one is needed in Mexico, why it's one of the deadliest places in the world for media workers?
Sure. I was actually yesterday at the home of Margarito Martinez. I spoke with his wife for, you know, quite a long time. The place where he was killed, it's very chilling. You walk up to her home and there's a spot, a very large spot, that was very clearly cleaned with flowers and with candles standing right next to it, sort of like a silent witness to what happened to Margarito. And the kind of journalism that Margarito Martinez was specialized in was the crime and security beat. What he did is he would get up in the morning and listen to radio frequencies of the Tijuana Municipal and State and the Baja California State Police, as well as the Red Cross. And whenever an incident would come in, Tijuana has on average 5 homicides a day, then he would jump in his car and just go to the place where the incident was reported, get out as soon as he can, take pictures, drive back home, and then upload those pictures to one or more of his many employees. And that particular kind of journalism is quite dangerous in Mexico and especially Tijuana, because it happens very often that when a journalist takes photos of these incidents, there might be someone there who doesn't like them to do it. For example, gang members or the family members of the people who were killed, who were shot. And journalists will be followed. They will be harassed by the police. They might receive death threats. So it's really a daily struggle for people like Margarito. And one of the things that I think is very important and which I think the Mexican state needs to clarify is that Margarito actually got in touch with the Federal Mechanism for the Protection of Journalists and Human Rights Defenders. That's an institution that functions under the coordination of the Mexican federal government. It was created 10 years ago this year. And it is a small institution that's focused on coordinating protection efforts with state governments and with federal agencies. The problem with this mechanism is that it's woefully insufficient. It's highly centralized in Mexico City. It doesn't have any regional representation in Mexico. And even if it were, even if it did have enough money, which it really doesn't, because it's only working with a budget of approximately just over $15 million a year, even if it had enough money, and even if it had enough public officials working for it that were well trained, then there was still the issue of impunity, the issue of crimes not being properly investigated by the Mexican authorities, which is what keeps incentivizing these killings. Apologies for the background noise. I'm here in Tijuana, and there's a little bit of a siren back there.
We totally understand. Can you talk about the effect of the U.S.-backed so-called war on drugs, its rise in Mexico, and whether it is connected to violence against journalists and human rights defenders?
There's a case of about 5 years ago, the murder of journalist Miroslava Breach in the northern Mexican state of Chihuahua. And in the years after she was murdered, she was a correspondent for national newspaper La Jornada. There have been numerous investigations into the circumstances of her death. And one of those investigations focused on the ballistic evidence, and the people who looked into that, they were able to link the murder weapon, the pistol Miroslava Breach was killed with, directly to the United States. It was a gun that was bought across the border, smuggled into Mexico, and then used for numerous crimes, including the murder of Miroslava Breach. In case of the murder of Margarito, Baja California state authorities have already been able to link that gun to at least 5 crimes, and there's a very high probability that that gun too has been smuggled into Mexico and then used by criminal gangs here. I think we cannot see the violence against journalists in Mexico as something independent from the war on drugs, because the numbers that at CPJ that we have indicate that the violence against journalists exploded just at a time when Mexico declared its U.S.-backed drug war against organized crime groups. The United States is a player in this violence, whether it likes it or not, because this is a transnational problem, and we just have no other way than to view the war on drugs as probably the main factor that fuels this violence from a sort of transnational, international perspective.
Finally, USA Today reports the Mexican government estimates more than 500,000 guns are smuggled from the U.S. each year. Can you end on that note, Jan Albert?
Absolutely. One of my colleagues, Joan Grillo, a British reporter here in Mexico, actually wrote a book about that called The Iron River. And it's a phenomenon that is apparently unstoppable. There are so many guns flowing southward. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of gun stores just across the border. The ease with which smugglers can buy guns in the United States and then smuggle them over the border to Mexico is staggering. And the current government under President López Obrador has actually been very vocal about the United States having to take measures against that. I think it's a very tall order. It is a matter of bilateral cooperation. In the United States, there isn't a lot of incentive currently to change it, you know, despite all the mass shootings in the U.S. But I don't think there's any other way than to drop the violence, than to at least address this issue in a bilateral sense.
Well, Jan Albert Hoetzen, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Dutch journalist and Mexico correspondent at the Committee to Protect Journalists, speaking to us from Tijuana, where Lourdes Maldonado was just memorialized at her funeral yesterday. She is one of three journalists to have been murdered in Mexico so far this year, in the first weeks of 2022. Next up, we go to Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem, where Israeli forces recently evicted a Palestinian family and demolished their home. We'll speak to the Sheikh Jarrah resident, Mohammed Okurd, well-known Palestinian poet and activist. Stay with us. Nadia Boulanger's pieces for cello and piano in C minor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An Israeli court has rejected a petition by a Palestinian family to let them rebuild their home in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem, a week after the Israeli military destroyed their home, demolished it. On January 19th, Israeli forces raided the home of the Saliha family early in the morning while the family slept. Several members of the family were assaulted. At least six were arrested. Mahmoud Saliha and his daughter Yasmin spoke about what happened.
At 2 a.m., my son woke me up and said that the army are entering the house. I couldn't leave the room. They came in and arrested me. They stepped on my back, and the officer said, "I told you I will come, evict you from your home, and I will let you leave your house like a dog, barefoot." He stepped on my back and told me, "Put your head down." I told him, "I never put my head down."
The house was demolished. I saw videos and live videos. My heart is broken. I don't know how to express myself. The house that I was raised in now is torn up. Everything in the house is gone. The feeling is so hard to see that my father's hard work for 25 years is demolished. Our memories, my father's heritage in this land, everything is gone. Even the cats and animals that were raised in the land are gone.
At least another 18 Palestinians who are at the home in solidarity with the family were also detained. Palestinians say it's the latest in a series of evictions aimed at expropriating land for Israeli settlers in violation of international law. We're joined now by Mohammed Okurd, a Palestine correspondent for The Nation, author of the recently published book of poems, Rifka. His family's home is in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem. He's joining us, though, now from New York City. Mohammed, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain what happened to the Saleha family? In fact, before the Israeli military destroyed their home, they said that they would burn it down to resist the eviction and the destruction. Tell us why their home was destroyed and what happened.
Absolutely, and thank you, Amy. It's good to be back. You know, we've all seen the videos of the Saleha family's home being demolished. It's important to note that the Israeli occupation court ruled that their land would be expropriated for quote-unquote public use for the building of a special needs school. The house, in fact, did not have a demolition order on it. What many Palestinians see this as is, in fact, an act of revenge, because the Saleha family stood its ground on the eviction day and confronted the forces and said that they would burn themselves alive should they be thrown out of their homes. And so this violent spectacle, this coming in and smacking down the doors and at dawn under the cover of darkness and insulting you and arresting and detaining the people in solidarity with you is not just to intimidate Palestinians and quell their resistance, but it's also to send a victory image to the Israeli audience that was very intimidated by the Saleha family's powerful stance against this position, against this possession. This is, in fact, an act of revenge. It also must be pointed that this is illegal under international law, given that Israeli jurisdiction over Palestinian land is illegitimate.
Can you talk about the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, where you and your twin sister and other Palestinians live? You've been detained many times, though your family's home has not been destroyed.
Absolutely. Sheikh Jarrah is one of the many neighborhoods in Jerusalem that is facing violent dispossession in a systemic rate to replace native Palestinians by settlers. In Sheikh Jarrah particularly, this is a case that has been going on for now 50 years. Our families have been going to court every single month trying to defend our homes, going up against billionaire-backed settler organizations. But I must say that this is not a unique situation for our neighborhood. It is happening all across colonized Palestine. My family today, our neighbors, still await a court decision pending to see whether or not we are going to remain in our homes. And this is just the reality for many, many, many hundreds of thousands of Palestinians.
What will happen to the Salhiyas now? How long have they lived in their home?
They've lived in their home for many, many decades, even before the Israeli occupation got to East Jerusalem in 67. No one knows. You know, many Palestinians that are expelled from their homes are working class families with nowhere else to go, with no one to turn to. And they are rendered homeless in the street. And this is happening in the cold of winter, nonetheless.
Can you talk about what is happening in related news in the occupied West Bank, where Omar Abdul-Majid Assad was just killed? Israeli forces, it's believed he was 80 years old. He's Palestinian-American. They stopped him while driving home, then dragged him out of the car, gagged and handcuffed him, left him to die. What do you know about this American citizen?
I know that he has gone through what many Palestinians of brutal Zionist force. I believe that he was killed by the Israeli occupation forces. You don't take a Palestinian elderly 80-year-old man, gag him, blindfold him, drag him in the street, and leave him in the cold with no intention to harm him. He was unresponsive while the Israeli forces were still there, according to eyewitnesses, and they just left him there to die. Of course, now the Israeli military is going to investigate itself and is going to find that it, in fact, have committed no atrocities and no crimes, and no one is going to be punished for what happened to this elderly man who very tragically was killed.
Mohammed, we usually speak to you in Sheikh Jarrah. Can you talk about what's brought you to the United States and also the anthology of your poetry? Can you talk about Rikva and why you named it Rikva?
Well, I'm here in the United States pursuing a master's degree, and I've come also to write, and I've come to write and publish writing in English about dispossession, about ethnic cleansing in Palestine. And this is why the name of my book, you know, is called Rifqa. It's named after my grandmother, who was dispossessed of her home in 1948 and then again in 2009. And had she been alive today, she would be facing the prospect of yet another Nakba, yet another act of violent displacement. This is also very true for the Salhiya family, whose home was just demolished. They once lived in the western part of Jerusalem before 1948, before they were forcibly expelled from their homes by Zionist militias. And now this is their second time experiencing the same agony and the same ethnic cleansing at the hands of the very same Zionist militias, only under a different name this time.
Let me also ask you about what's happening in the Nakab and the Negev region.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I think it's really important to note that there are thousands of Palestinian Bedouins currently in the Naqab region in the south of historic Palestine that have cultivated their lands and inhabited for decades and decades on end, yet have not had their ownership, quote-unquote, recognized by the Israeli government, that are now facing displacement at the hands of the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, which, as Al Jazeera's journalist Zeynep Tahan reports, is a quasi-government agency that is mandated with leasing and developing land with Jews only and owns 13% of Israeli, quote-unquote, state lands. Most of these lands were obtained through the anti-Palestinian absentee property law that expropriated property from Palestinian refugees who were forced out of their homes in 1948. All of these thousands of Palestinians, Bedouins, today face the prospect of homelessness and also face a violent crackdown because they have said no time and time again to this forestation efforts by the JNF, which, by the way, many have called greenwashing. They are uprooting Palestinians to replace them with invasive species of trees. It's also really important to note that the JNF is a charity, is registered in the United States as a charity organization, as a tax-exempt organization that is committing international law violations abroad and thus violating American law. I also want to echo the calls and demands for the Global Days of Actions made and called on by the activists from the Naqab in the south who are facing this dispossession. They are asking that their demolition orders be ended, that the forestation efforts be ended, and that ethnic cleansing at large in Palestine must come to an end. There are global actions all around the globe today and tomorrow and the day after tomorrow demanding an end to ethnic cleansing, be it in the Naqab, in the South Hebron Hills, in Jerusalem, or in the West Bank.
Well, Mohammed Okurd, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Palestine correspondent for The Nation magazine, author of the recently published book of poems, Rifqa. His family's home is in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem. When we come back, Downfall, the case against Boeing. A new documentary just premiered at Sundance that looks at the two fatal crashes of the Boeing 737 MAX in Ethiopia and Indonesia, killing all 346 people on board. We'll speak with the director of Downfall, Rory Kennedy, as well as the father of one of the victims, Michael Stamo. Stay with us. Bernard Herrmann's Send the More from Vertigo. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Relatives of passengers who died in a pair of fatal crashes of Boeing 737 MAX jets in Ethiopia and Indonesia are urging Attorney General Merrick Garland to reopen a $2.5 billion settlement that the Trump administration reached with Boeing in its final days in office last year. Under the settlement, Boeing avoids criminal prosecution over its role in two of the deadliest airplane crashes in years. Attorney General Garland held a video meeting with several family members Wednesday. The first crash occurred on October 29, 2018, when a Lion Air flight in Indonesia crashed after taking off from Jakarta, killing all 189 people aboard. Just after 5 months later, on March 10, 2019, an Ethiopian Airlines flight crashed minutes after taking off from Addis Ababa. 157 people died, everyone on board. Both planes were using a new flawed automated flight control system that activated erroneously. The story of the Boeing crashes and the company's push for profit over safety are told in a stunning new documentary called Downfall, The Case Against Boeing. It just premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. This is an excerpt featuring Grima Sethi, the wife of Bavi Sineja, who died in the crash of Lion Air Flight 610 in Indonesia. He was the pilot.
My husband prepared his flight bag, checked his schedule, checked out with his colleague that he's flying with. We had a meal and had a chat for 20, 30 minutes. That was the normal routine before he left for his flight. After he left, I went back to sleep. And after a few hours, I was expecting a call from him. You know, just normal working day. Got a call from one of his colleagues. We are not able to find his aircraft. I'm like, don't worry, because I knew my husband. I knew how he flew. I was just expecting a call from him, you know. I've reached. That was the norm that we used to follow. So I was expecting that call from him instead of anyone else. And after that, it's just been everyone knows.
That was Grima Sethi, the wife of the Indonesian pilot in the Lion Air flight that went down in 2018. And that excerpt is from the upcoming Netflix documentary Downfall, The Case Against Boeing. We're joined now by two guests, the film's director and producer, Rory Kennedy. She's an Academy Award-nominated, Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker, and Michael Stumo, who is the father of Samia Stumo, who died in the Ethiopian Airlines crash in March of 2019, not 6 months after the Indonesian flight. Michael, I want to begin with you, and I wanted to start off by sharing all of our condolences on the death of Samia, who I had gotten a chance to meet when she was alive, a beautiful young activist committed to social change. And I wanted to give my condolences to your family. We had spoken with Ralph Nader, her grand uncle at the time, but I haven't spoken to you and to your wife, Nadja. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for letting me be here.
So, Michael, you just met with Merrick Garland, the attorney general. Before we talk about this really stunning documentary, I wanted to ask you about this latest news, what you are calling for.
The criminal settlement, the deferred prosecution agreement with Boeing in the latter days of the Trump administration after Attorney General Barr had left, caused surprise, anger, and grief among all the crash families who are connected in a WhatsApp group globally. Just erupted in anger. They never talked to us, despite me and my wife asking to speak to the DOJ a few months before. Hey, what's going on in this criminal investigation? They said they denied there was an investigation. Everybody knew there was an investigation. They denied there was. We knew we had rights under a law called the Crime Victims' Rights Act to meet and confer with prosecutors and have a say in their investigation and their decisions. They said there wasn't one. Then all of a sudden on January 1st, 2021, we find, oh, there's a criminal settlement, a deferred prosecution agreement that immunizes Boeing executives and throws a couple pilots under the bus. So this challenge is by law professor Paul Cassell, who's an expert in crime victims' rights, and it alleges that the Crime Victims' Rights Act was violated. We want to reopen the DPA. We don't want justice to fight us on that. It's under new leadership with Merrick Garland. Garland has, in fact, fought for victims' rights in a prior life in the past as a lawyer. And we asked that he, agree with us, or at least not fight us on asking that as a declaration that our rights were violated and that we should have the opportunity to meet and confer. And in fact, we ultimately want this agreement reopened so that our input is reflected and it's not a hasty rush job at the end of an administration.
And what's your sense of the direction the attorney general go? Again, to summarize, the Department of Justice has charged Boeing with criminal conspiracy to defraud the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. Boeing agreed to pay $2.5 billion in fines and compensations, but the arrangement allows the company to avoid criminal prosecution.
Yes. So just one correction there. Boeing only paid $243.7 million in fines. The rest of it was mostly to airline customers that they had harmed, that where they had to owe the money anyway because of the grounding. So they threw that money plus some money to families to make it look like a bigger settlement. It was only $243 million. As expected in the meeting, Merrick Garland was very empathetic, very sincere. He listened carefully. We did not expect him to say which way he was going in the meeting, and he did not.
I want to bring Rory Kennedy into this conversation. This film is jaw-dropping. You go deep into Boeing's history and essentially into the cover-up. Talk about why you decided to make Downfall the case against Boeing and what you discovered as you investigated this.
Thank you, Amy. And I appreciate so much being on your show, being back here with you. Like so many people, I followed this story where we witnessed two airplanes crash within 5 months of each other, the same airplane, the 737 MAX. 346 people lost their lives. And I wanted to know what happened. I wanted to know who knew what when, who was responsible for these planes crashing, for these lives lost. And I wanted to ultimately make a documentary where we could learn from those mistakes, hold those people accountable, and try our best to ensure that this doesn't happen again.
So take us through the two crashes. I mean, What was some of the most galling parts of this were the blame that Boeing placed on the pilots and also on the countries, as if to say in developing countries, they just can't handle quite our planes. Let me turn to another clip from the documentary Downfall, the case against Boeing, which premiered Friday at Sundance.
An Ethiopian Airlines flight has crashed shortly after takeoff.
2 days after the second crash, we knew that this plane appeared to be defective in some manner.
It was their greed. Are the profits more important than the human life?
It was their greed, says Gurima Sethi. And you also see in this clip Congressmember DeFazio, who led a deep investigation into what took place, the Oregon congressmember. But talk about first Lion Air and how Boeing responded, and then this unprecedented crash just months later, the same thing happens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that was shocking to me to discover in the making of this film is that as far back as 2013, there are meeting minutes that we document and are shown in the film that show that Boeing was trying to hide the existence of the MCAS system to the FAA, to the regulators.
And explain MCAS, which no one knew, even the journalists, even the many technicians and FAA folks even knew what MCAS was.
Well, worse than that, a lot of the pilots didn't know what it was and that it was in the plane. So the MCAS system was basically a computer system. This plane was built based on a model from a 737 model that was built in the 60s. So it was basically retrofitted with larger engines because Boeing wanted to get to market faster and wanted to save money. So they retrofitted, they put these very large engines, and the aerodynamics of the plane didn't function properly in certain conditions. So instead of rebuilding the plane, they, again, in an effort to save money, decided to rely on this system, a computer system, to fix the problem. And basically what this computer system did was push the nose of the plane downward. The problem, I mean, one of the many problems was that it relied on a single sensor, which is not consistent with regulations. You can't have one sensor that could have a catastrophic impact. That sensor broke. It sent erroneous information to this computer system, and the nose of the plane kept pushing downward. Every 10 seconds, it would push downward. And in the first plane, that Lion Air airplane crash, they didn't even know the system was on the plane. We later found out, which was equally blew me away, that Boeing knew, based on their internal research, that if pilots didn't respond within 4 to 10 seconds of the system breaking down, that the result would be catastrophic. And catastrophic means that the airplane would crash and everybody would die on it. So they knew that as far back as 2016, and they still put these planes up in the air. And as you point out, after that first Lion Air crash, they blame the pilots, even knowing that it was the system that was faulty on this aircraft. So it was, you know, you can imagine Garima, who we just, you know, we heard from, not only having to deal with the loss of her husband, but and who had committed himself to really protecting his passengers and was an extraordinary pilot, to not only have to deal with his loss, but then to deal with, you know, this onslaught of press that suggested that her pilot husband was responsible for this.
And so that was Lion Air, and they could get away with that for as long as there wasn't the second crash where the same thing happened. And in fact, these pilots, because of the first, though they weren't trained in a simulator, they were alerted to this MCAS, which, as you said, pushed the nose of the plane down. You had to act within 10 seconds, turning off the system. They couldn't deny it anymore, though it seemed like they were hiring more PR people, as you point out in the documentary, than they were dealing with how to take these planes out of service until they could figure it out.
Well, you know, the truth is, Amy, I mean, okay, so between the first crash and the second crash, the other thing, you know, an additional memo and document is revealed in the film, which is a Tarim report. And the Tarim report showed that Boeing knew and the FAA knew that this plane had a likelihood of crashing 15 times over the course of its lifetime. Mm-hmm. So that would average out as once every 2 years. There would be a catastrophic crash like this. And they decided to keep the plane in the air knowing that. That's, to me, absolutely outrageous. I mean, to think that we are putting our children, our families, ourselves on these airplanes, and that Boeing and the FAA would allow a plane like this to go back in the air, again, in the interest of saving money, because to ground the plane would cost Boeing millions and up to billions of dollars. But still, after the second airplane crash, first of all, they kept it in the air for 3 days until there were a number of other countries, including China and the European Union, that grounded the aircraft. We only did that after 3 days here in the United States. And Boeing still blamed the pilots after that second airplane crash.
Talking about their stupidity. I mean, the whole thing was incredible. But you also point out the corporate merger between Boeing and McDonnell Douglas played a key role.
Yes, this was back in the 90s. And that, you know, I mean, Boeing is a company that I have huge respect for. It's been a driving force in our economy and really was on the forefront of pushing the envelope in commercial air, allowing us to be able to travel all over the world after World War II. You know, it was involved in getting the rockets up to the moon. You know, so it's had this extraordinary history and has really focused historically on engineering and excellence and safety. And that all seemed to change when they merged with McDonnell Douglas. McDonnell Douglas was a flailing company, and somehow the people who worked at McDonnell Douglas ended up, you know, one person we interviewed said they bought Boeing with Boeing's money and somehow took charge of the company and really turned it into a company that prioritized profits over safety.
Michael Stumo, the organizing that the families of the plane victims did, what you did, going hearing after hearing to Washington, D.C., this international community, because one of the planes went down in Indonesia, one in Ethiopia, and the image of you standing behind the CEO of Boeing in one of those hearings, each of you holding the pictures of your loved ones. Talk about the organizing that has exposed so much of what Boeing did.
Crash happened in March 10th of 2019. At the end of April, we learned that the FAA was planning to update pilot training for the MAX so that they received another hour of computer training. We knew then that the fix was in. They were trying to just do minimal changes to get that MAX up in the air. We were, you know, on the floor. I mean, we were just grieving. We're trying to recover, and then we realized, you know, we have to go to Washington, All the while, my wife Nadia was and I were connecting with families, family members, crash families were reaching out to each other, connected in a WhatsApp group, connected in other ways. And Nadia and I went to Washington and met with 56 different members of the Senate Commerce Committee and House Transportation Committee.
We have 20 seconds. Story
every time. And the getting the families to Washington with the pictures many times in front of the decision makers was difficult but important to let them know what was at stake.
And we will continue to follow the pressure you're bringing on the Attorney General and on Boeing on the what will come out of this horror that took place. Michael Stumo, father of Samia Stumo, who died in the Ethiopian Airlines crash, and Rory Kennedy, director of Downfall, the case against Boeing. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
One way to get out. What's a die-eye trip?